general remarks and delineate the areas I want to explore, and then I'll put points to David and I'll ask him to respond. First of all, I'm Richard Cooper. I'm one of the people who was at the founding meeting of Jews for Justice for Palestinians early in, I think it was 2002, the date will be somewhere in the book, which is extremely thorough and very comprehensive attempt to analyze developments over the last 10 years or so. I would strongly recommend it, and it's here, it's on sale, there will be time afterwards. I'd insist on David signing it, because these copies may prove valuable one day, but it's worth reading and worth thinking about. I have some problems with it, and I want to push David on those. The first is to do with the sociological language David uses. The second is to do with notions of solidarity. The third is perhaps more parochial, the very specific criticisms he makes of Jews for Justice for Palestinians, some of which I think are exaggeratedly critical or willfully misunderstanding, but I know that's not the case, and I want to push David so that we can try and have some discussion about this. And finally, if there's time, I'd like us to also look at the theme of anti-Semitism, which isn't particularly dealt with in the book, but which I think frames much of what takes place in the movement, and it might be worth developing that further. So first of all, the issue of the language. I was, for my sins, a sociologist, at least in one or two incarnations of parts of my life in the past, and I actually taught a thing called social movements. I always wondered when I was doing it whether anything I was saying was of any relevance whatsoever to people who were acting in these movements, myself included, who was active at the time in various movements and talking about them. But the distance was always quite big. And the language has developed. I mean, I was very critical as a student and then as a lecturer of what we called in those days bourgeois sociology, to which we counterposed a Marxist-inflected analysis of society. And that was fine while there were immediate activities related to that kind of analysis where that analysis made sense. Later on in the 80s and the 90s, it became more problematic to simply have an activist approach. And one was trying to interrogate the theory that we were teaching and see to what extent it actually would be helpful for any people who are trying to change the world, which then and now I think is the only object of social theory. Social movement theory, and in this book, I found, even though I knew much of the literature, and even though David expresses it in fairly simple, relatively straightforward language, I found quite often I was brought up short by it. And I think many people reading the book will have that experience. It is difficult, and you ask yourself, is it adding? Is it clarifying? Why is it necessary? Why do we do this? I don't have an answer. I'm not saying it should have been left out. Some of the concepts in the book I did find very helpful. The Bourdieu ones, which David is very keen on, I was less taken by, but I could see why he wanted to use them. I found a concept he used coming from Sidney Tarrow, who's written about social movements since the 60s onwards, of rooted cosmopolitanism, I thought very helpful. Though when David contrasts rooted cosmopolitanism with solidarity, later on, when we discuss JFJFB, I will question his use or his understanding of that concept, which I think makes it less helpful than I had found it in the first instance. So the first question I just want to throw to David, without going into any specific details, is really to ask him what he thinks the social theory adds to the book. And my underlying assumption is it must add something, because otherwise we would all just be unreflective commentators on social action, social change, and social movements. And we obviously reflect all the time on what we're doing, what we think it is about, and so on. What do these concepts give that we wouldn't have through a more, perhaps, common sense understanding of what we're doing? So if I can throw that one at you first.
You can, and actually it's the hardest question I think you'll throw at me. Because it is something I've been asking myself. Like yourself, I basically got, well, I'm possibly not like yourself, but I got into the academy because I thought that through kind of academic knowledge, it would help the understanding of social movements. And I have to say, my first experience of reading social movement theory, because I kind of generally like reading sociology, it's kind of a generally interesting subject, but social movement theory is great. There is a kind of a horrific attempt to kind of take kind of like interesting stuff that's happening in real life and make general level theories of it, which quite often is the sociology of the being obvious. So there was a lot of, this was my first reaction to social movement theory, and I'm wondering whether like I've experienced Stockholm syndrome in a way, without knowing it, I've got too much. But I mean, your question was, how much does it add? In relation to Bourdieu, this is the bit that I think everybody else, most of the people who've read the book and like commented on it, said, why the hell is there so much Bourdieu there? This, I think, in fairness, is extremely valuable. Because I think through thinking in terms of fields of practice, it helps us understand quarrels and arguments and differences. It gives us a structure to understand them. It doesn't give us a structure perhaps to resolve them, but in a way that it allows us to allows us to theorize in a better way the movement. It certainly allowed me to theorize the movement, which is why I was quite enthusiastic about it, although saying there's problems with Bourdieu and so on. So I would say that was useful. I would say identity, the idea of identity and movement. Again, I hope I didn't jargonize too much in relation to that. But yeah, thinking through when people were talking about their stories and themselves, the way of understanding what they were saying, I have to say the literature on identity and movements was actually very useful. So if there's too much jargon in it, then I do apologize, but definitely, I think you need to theorize. I think we can't just do journalism. Because if we just do journalism, it also just involves kind of pat on the back. Aren't we wonderful? Look what's going on. There's so much movement. Isn't because there's so much movement in and of itself a good thing? Well, I'd say not necessarily. Sometimes it is. And I would say this theory does allow us to think through what's going on.
Perhaps I should add for people who haven't read the book yet, parts of the book consist of interviews with activists, and David teases out their stories, they're long quotes from what they said, and he teases out the contradictory meaning sometimes, and the development in their positions, and all of that I do think is extremely valuable, and the simplistic kind of notions of Jewish identity, Otto Lengi, people in this movement are just wrestling with their tortured Jewish identities. For instance, I think are just so much nonsense and unhelpful in understanding. They clearly are just ways of dismissing a political movement which someone like Otto Lengi finds unpalatable, or indeed someone like Gilad Atzmon from the other side comes up with similar kinds of dismissals. And that they aren't helpful. But there are other people who try to explore the contradictions in Jewish identity, the extent to which Jews are taking on their Jewish identity merely as instrumental, speaking as Jews only on this issue, while not caring at all about being Jewish in other contexts. And David has very valuable stuff in here about how this is not really the case. And the interviews and so on show a kind of development and a kind of movement in people, in the movements. And I would say one of the concepts I would like to see, but this is just my past rather than yours, is the notion of a dialectical development, what you call tensions in the movement. There really does seem to be a dialectical development within the movements. And for me, it's easier to think back into more traditional Marxian ways of reflection on this than perhaps David, coming in a different generation, to political activity finds easy. But I think the stuff is there and there's plenty to think about. But what I want to go on to is one of the core notions that David deals with, and to question the way he structures it. And this is the notion of solidarity. He says, and I'll give a few quotes at different points. aid and human rights organizations commonly do not offer support for Palestinian resistance, a key division in the Palestinian distance issue movement. Or what does supporting Palestinians mean for participants? Does it mean supporting Palestinian struggle or charitable support or something else entirely? To answer it, it's necessary to place these groups within their wider context. And David seems to have a division whereby Palestine solidarity, for instance, is political, MAP, medical aid for Palestinians, is charitable, amnesty is human rights. And I want to question that division. And he also goes on, and I'll come to this as well, to give a particular example of the solidarity element, which he argues is increasingly focused on the boycott campaign. And I want to argue for a much wider view of how we ought to interpret solidarity. He uses the debate over the boycott, as he puts it, as a marker of political positions. Okay, now, it seems to me that there are many forms of political resistance. In fact, we came into this movement when the dominant form of Palestinian political resistance that we had to relate to was terrorism and suicide bombing. That was what framed all the debates from 2002 onwards in terms of the public discourse. And it was a political form of intervention which we rejected. I think parts of the solidarity movement, in my own view, did not reject it forcefully enough. But I think it was important to reject it, to argue that there was no strategic future through that, and there was no moral basis for that form of political action. But it was another form of political. There is non-violent resistance, which is curiously absent from David's discussion, and that must mean, in some ways, it's curiously absent from JFJFB minutes, because he read all of the minutes and kind of processed them. But in fact, we gave a lot of support to various forms of non-violent resistance. The International Solidarity Movement, in fact, the Palestinian-inspired movement, was what JFJP originally came out of, the experience of Irini Bruegel in Amman ISM tour, Joe Berg, who started the Olive Co-op and tour of Israel-Palestine, was also involved in the ISM in that period. The whole story of the resistances and the deaths of people like Rachel Corrie, Tom Herndl and so on, which we were very active around, you know, with Tom Herndl came from up the road from where we lived. And Rachel Corrie in solidarity with the Corrie family and activities around that. Later on, we participated in solidarity actions with things like the resistance at Billion and Nilin, earlier at Woodruff's and so on. We worked with Combatants for Peace, with Hassan Aramin, a Palestinian whose daughter was killed about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, by an Israeli policeman as she was leaving school, just gunned down. Was and is a heroic figure, and spoke at one of our annual meetings. So the question of how you define solidarity and why solidarity is reduced or regarded broadly through boycott eyes is something I would like to question. And even then, I would say, if you're looking at boycott, you actually are looking at boycott, divestment, sanctions, the whole range of solidarity actions which are possible now. And there was long-standing JFJFB campaigning, for instance, on the EU-Israel's association agreement, and calling for Israel to be sanctioned for being in breach of the terms of the agreement, against arms sales to Israel, against Caterpillar, Veolia, BT, and other companies profiting from the occupation and so on. Now, that is obviously within the definition of solidarity, as they phrases it. But also I want to add the human rights and charity, it seems to me, are often sometimes essentially political. You look at what Amnesty does, you look at what War on Want has done. War on Want is a major political intervener in the struggle, as people have attempted to get War on Want struck off as a charity and failing to do so, have tried, have argued again and again. It is political. You're allowed to be political in terms of what charities can do today. And finally, I just want to stress a cultural or a concept, sumud, patience, which is a word that the Palestinians use to describe their situation over decades. Patience, waiting, keeping themselves in reserve and the work done by solidarity activists, and I'm using the word solidarity here, solidarity activists abroad, to twin with Palestinian towns, to support Palestinian organizations, to support joint Israeli-Palestinian initiatives, the ones that promote, all seem to be part of what I would push into the solidarity network. And I would argue that it ought to be conceived more broadly than you've done in the book. And when you go on to your criticism of JFJFP, you can see I'm already elaborated some of the arguments against some of the things you say.
Okay, well, actually, here I disagree with you. The first one I was kind of half agreeing with you, Neil, but and where I disagree with you, actually, is that you can argue, of course, aid is political. I mean, the fact that the BBC decided not to broadcast the Gaza, the kind of like aid to Gaza advert, indicates that, yeah, of course, aid is political. Yeah, of course, human rights is political. You can have a very broad definition of political. But what interested me is that they're not just political, they're also extremely anti-political in their own ways. And if you take the whole charity discourse, and I think your tripartite division actually is kind of bringing out, should I say, the tripartite division I had, that you have charity, you have human rights work, and you have political support, is actually a useful one. And you can regard them all under the ambit of politics, obviously. And most organisations which are interested in, let's say, some aspect of like supporting Palestinians would be involved in some kind of admixture of all three. But at the same time, there is a difference, and there is a significant difference between supporting Palestinian resistance and supporting Palestinian human rights. And this links to the depoliticisation, or the depoliticising effect of human rights discourse that regards to an extent the people under this discourse as victims. So yes, we can be political when we talk about human rights, but the Palestinians are not conceived of in this discourse as political beings. They are conceived of as victims who we have moral duty, and I've nothing against moral duties, by the way, but that we have a moral duty to help. And I think there is a place for that, but that is completely different to the idea of supporting active Palestinian struggle for their own future. And if I didn't, one thing I do hope is that resistance obviously involves all aspects of nonviolent resistance. It involves like supporting combat needs, it involves the work that JFJFP does, obviously, because this is supporting active Palestinian efforts to, as I say, make their own future. The one thing I disagree with you here, by the way, is somewhat I always thought would translate as steadfast rather than patience. You know, patience means, in a way, it's easy for us to cancel patience. You know, I've no bother to understand patience. Waiting for things, maybe in 5 years' time, things will get better over there. Whereas somewhat steadfastness in the face of oppression is, I think, something different here. And regard and needs kind of active support. The other thing is that you're saying, which I agree with you, is that in a way I was collapsing all forms of solidarity in the boycott actions, which I possibly do too much, but I do because Palestinians are a large element of Palestinian civil society increasingly does this. There is, of course, the resistance, non-violent, heroic resistance of villages like Benin and Elim. That's without doubt. These are villages. These are isolated villages. If we talk about Palestinian society and the entire Palestinian diaspora, which is part of Palestinian society, partly because of closing down of all the other options, and I've no bother about closing down environment options, but closing down of all other options is increasingly stressing boycott. And I think that is really has been increasingly the question for the movement. What aspect and what attitude do we have or does it have towards boycott? And I think, yeah, that is an increasing question. Of course you can have a nuanced attitude. There's no two ways about that. But there's no denying the salience of boycott when you talk about resistance.
somewhat steadfastness. I accept my reading of the word patience is broader than perhaps the word conveys. Steadfastness in the face of oppression. And anything that supports that steadfastness is, I think, what we in JFJFP and in the broader movement have always been concerned with trying to build. But on, and moving on to JFJFP now, two kind of separate areas, I think. One is a particular leaflet that David analyzes, which I want to say something about. But before that, on the issue of the boycott, David writes, it seems that for those working to maintain organizational coherence and trying to affect the community, boycott is at best a narcissistic distraction from this work. Now, in JFJFP, from day one, we took on a double task. One was to express solidarity with Palestinians in their struggle for economic, social, political rights, etc. The other was to try to influence the Jewish community. And we were aware from day one that there would be a tension between these two goals. And in fact, it was expressed in the first years by resolution after resolution to change our name because Palestinians put off people in the Jewish community, to which those of us who didn't want to change the name, you know, kind of said, they maybe have to learn to live with it, that it does what it says on the tin. This is a movement of Jews for justice for Palestinians, and this is part of what we're doing. And it would be wrong to change that, because we're not going to get this goal achieved within the Jewish community by stealth. We're going to have to get it achieved. And what we were trying to do was really to win a place in the community where this discourse was an acceptable part of what it was to be Jewish. And this is where it links back very much to what David says in the book about identity. When JFJFP was launched, and in the first few months, we were vilified. We weren't noticed in the Jewish Chronicle for about 2 years. And then we were noticed time after time to be condemned without ever having been acknowledged as existing in the first place. But even that condemnation was saying somehow that we were making an impression and in a way in which we couldn't any longer be ignored. And from our point of view, the identity thing that struck me most at that time was I hadn't, in a sense, cared particularly about the internal organization of the Jewish community until we were excluded from it. And the issue arose of what kind of community or communities was it? Because actually, it's a fantastically fragmented, diverse, rich community. It's not all totally reactionary. The Board of Deputies does not represent the mainstream political views of the community as a whole. In my view, nor does the Chief Rabbi represent religious Jews in this country. He is one among others. And what it became was a struggle for pluralism within the Jewish community and the right for diversity and the right to be heard. And that's part of what JFJFP was doing within the Jewish community. But the right to be heard also meant the right to be able to say things that people didn't like and to be heard on them. And the thing we wanted to say that wasn't like was that Palestinians were on the receiving, you know, they were on the rough end of Israeli policy and the Jewish community and its organization, you know, the spokespeople of that community were staying silent. And therefore, you know, we tried to find ways of influencing that community. For instance, I mean, in the early days, we went into a Jewish, a Zionist Federation rally for Israel with a leaflet saying, buy your olive oil from Judea and Samaria, which we gave out, and on the back we said, unfortunately, this oil is not available because Judea and Samaria are under occupation and you're unable to get this oil at the present time. It caused quite a lot of a guffaw in the community, with the duty thrown out of the rally and so on. There were numbers of initiatives like that. But the question is whether these actions orienting on the community blunted or undermined the work that we were doing in solidarity with the Palestinians. And this is where David seems to be arguing that we turned Palestinians into a charity case, pitting Palestine as a victim denies Palestinians the ability to represent themselves, he says in a discussion on alternative tourism. And he gave an example of how Bedouins and cave dwellers described in 2004 as powerless, little connection to the outside world. And he argues that what we're doing is rendering the Palestinians victims of our largesse, our kind of superior insight, information, influence, or whatever it is. And I want to argue that that is essentially wrong, but that isn't what we did, and it isn't by and large what happened. I mean, I don't want to say we were perfect. I mean, I don't want to say that nothing is open to criticism. And I've learned a lot by reading David's criticisms of various aspects of what we tried to do. But that particular intervention, I mean, you've got to remember, in this particular case, when you're dealing with the Bedouin and the cave dwellers, they are on the margins of Palestinian society, let alone on the margins of Western society or anything else. Most of the Palestinians we were working with were not particularly enamored of support for the struggle, for those struggles either. And there were struggles that were taken on, in part by Gush Shalom, an Israeli group who we worked with, although we had many disagreements with. And we ended up setting up a charity, British Shalom Salaam Trust, which I don't think is mentioned, through which many forms of support of Palestinians were channeled, including support for the cave dwellers, including, for instance, money to pay a bus driver who takes the bus from a village in the South Hebron Hills with school kids so they can get to school because otherwise they would be stoned by sandals. Is this charity in any simple sense? Is this treating the Palestinians as victims? It isn't experienced that way by the village group, the villagers group, let me tell you, who are very grateful. Now, grateful maybe, you know, is a reprise of this sort of language of charity. And I don't mean it in that sense. They see the help we're giving through this charity as helping them in their struggle, helping them in the maintenance of sumud and in actual resistance. So I don't think the lines that are drawn between these things stand up nearly as clearly as David does. And I just want to get on to one thing where he takes a leaflet we gave out at the end of January 2007, a leaflet on a demonstration in support of Gaza, where he says, what we're doing is we're supporting, our focus is on the Israeli groups who are trying to break the siege of Gaza, which it is. We aren't giving the Palestinians any kind of visibility as actors in the struggle. We're reinforcing their victim position. And I would say in response to that, A, this leaflet actually said, you know, these Israeli groups are taking this aid, where they will be met on the other side by the Palestinian International Campaign to End the Siege, the psychiatrist Dr. Ayad Siraj, and together they will demand that Israel lift the siege of Gaza immediately. It seems to me this is a perfect, this was the day before they were taking the aid through. It seems to be a very reasonable way of responding to that demonstration. It's not that on other occasions we didn't raise other issues. On that occasion, David praises PSC for having shown the way forward with political demands, which included things like lobby your MP. I can't tell David the number of leaflets we've put out telling people to lobby their MPs and the number of times we've gone on lobbies and so on. He said he praised PSC for saying they should respect Palestinian democracy, a code for support for Hamas. 3 months earlier, we published an advert in the Times calling on David Miliband of the United Nations to, you know, to call for discussions with Hamas. So I kind of think these, I mean, I don't want to get into nitpicking, but I think these kind of, I think it's too easy to take a particular example of a particular leader at a particular time and generalize too far from it. We were trying to balance a number of things. The question is, overall, did we get the balance right? Could it have been better? The answer, yes, of course it could have been better. Inevitably it could have been better. Did we, in that process, overall reinforce the notion of Palestinians as victims? And I do not believe that is the case. I think it's an important point to look at. I think it's quite obvious that solidarity movements, by their nature, often do take over the struggle and represent the struggle in a way that suits them and not the way the people on the ground are actually leading that struggle. But what I'd just stress and throw this back to David at this point is it is very difficult now to know what voices in Palestinian society one is expressing solidarity with. There are many different voices pushing in different directions. My feeling is one wants to express solidarity with as many of them as we can. And if the movements in Britain and elsewhere bifurcate or split into many groups, some of which support some of these actions and others support others, that's okay as long as they're not competing with each other, as long as they're not undermining each other, as long as they're not diminishing the overall effect. My feeling over the last 10 years is generally we did quite well at not undercutting each other, at respecting people in the solidarity movement with whom we disagreed, sometimes quite violently, but giving them their space to do what they wanted, and they gave us our space. And on some occasions, for instance, in the Enough Coalition, 40 years after the occupation of the West Bank, we were actually able to put together a coalition of over 50 groups, development, charity, church, political, Jewish, Muslim, and others, to try and work together on this issue. It was okay in 67 on the issue of occupation. It was not possible to hold that coalition together the following year for a number of reasons, all of which are instructive as to the difficulties and problems of building solidarity.
Okay. I see there's a note from the chair, so I'll be kind of brief on this. But I mean, it's really interesting points you raise, because the last thing I wanted to do in writing the book was to give some kind of ultra-leftist criticism of what actual people were doing on the ground and were feeling as useful, because that's really easy, you know? It's really easy to be this outside academic coming in, pointing fingers, saying, oh no, you're not perfect enough. It's really easy because of not being involved in real life situations that you were involved in. So what I hoped I was doing generally with, I mean, in fairness, JFJFP was only one of the groups I was looking at. But in general, what I was doing was, rather than doing this ultra-leftist thing of, yeah, you're not perfect, was showing that your responses were situated political responses. That rather than necessarily praising people who support, I mean, like in my political work, I do a lot of boycott activism, but I didn't want to get into this nonsense of saying people who do boycott activism are good, people who don't do boycott activism, Jesus, they just don't get it. Because I think it's nonsense. Because what we are trying to do is affect change in specific political situations. Again, this is the advantage of the idea of fields and people involved in various fields of practice. So without doubt, I think that people involved in the Jewish field of practice, it just does make sense not to forward the idea of boycott. But of course, a group like JFJFP and all the other national groups that I was analysing, or most of the other national groups that I was analysing, had their feet in both camps. They were trying to affect broader political movement within their country, and within that movement, it kind of made sense to say, like, unless you sanction Israel for its behaviour, it's going to keep on doing what it's doing. And they were also trying to affect other Jews, bring other Jews along, try to kind of change what being Jewish is about, so that it doesn't simply revolve around unthinking support for Israel, but is more complex and more nuanced. So I think most groups face this dilemma. And so rather than thinking that, that there's a certain group of people who just prioritize boycott, a certain group of people who just prioritize being Jewish, it's a dilemma that actually the groups and the individuals have within themselves. If on some of the occasions I wasn't subtle enough on it, I know it's too broad brush, apologies. On the specific leaflet now, I did use that as an example because, oh God, it was such a telling example. And it was rather, I mean, I did say, look, this is one example of this. I think I was saying JFJFP does other stuff. But in this particular example, what was done was, rather than forwarding Palestinian subjectivity and what they're doing, what was done is forwarding the Israeli narrative. And it was, just possibly to me, it was just such an obvious thing, the differences between the two leaflets handed out at the same time. And it was less that I was praising PSC more that I was contrasting this issue of solidarity, which is a huge problem, which we have only scraped the surface of, with this idea of supporting Israeli movements, which is useful, but which also has its own downside. So I don't know if that answered, but I didn't want to do, as I say, just this criticism.
Can I just push back? Yes, I'd just like to push back on this notion of supporting Palestinians' subjectivity, which I think it is important to do, and I think David's book is a useful corrective and makes you, you know, stop and think, did we notice enough who we were acting in support of, or were we just acting in terms of the local feel and, you know, how we would get the Board of Deputies not to be quite as obnoxious as they might be or whatever. And I think those questions are important to ask. But supporting Palestinian subjectivity, this is the problem I have with the boycott, and maybe people here will have something to say on it. Because in terms of what Palestinians do on the ground, by and large they don't do boycotts. They call for boycott. Other people do boycott. Boycott, for people within Palestinian society, boycott is not a major element in holding their resistance together. It's non-violent resistance, it's cultural education, it's all kinds of other things. And my feeling is finding ways of supporting those and building on those is also terribly important, because otherwise we are just voyeurs on the reality of what is going on, which is precisely your critique of us. And the danger is that boycott can, in a sense, reinforce
that. Okay, it's a really interesting point. And I'm going to totally sidestep this by saying, because I'm noticing that it's 8 o'clock, and I'm actually just wondering actually if there's anything to do with
Thank you very much.